Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org, where audio and video links to past programs are available. I'm Narcy David, food and wine editor at KCBS Radio in San Francisco, and the moderator for tonight's program. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce our guest, Chef Martin Yan. Martin is a longtime Bay Area resident, an internationally recognized master chef, and an expert, of course, in the art of Asian cuisine. In 1978, he started the first public television show dealing with a daily cooking, and that was the Chinese cooking show known as Yan Can Cook. It's become an award-winning series on PBS. I was really fascinated to discover that he started this shortly after he'd picked up a master's in science, an MS, at UC Davis, where he was studying food science. It just sort of evolved into doing a little cooking demonstration, and one thing leads to another. He's authored over 30 cookbooks, has 3,750 TV shows under his belt. He's a food consultant. He's taught at places like the Culinary Institute of America. We like to call that the CIA, the Chinese Cuisine Institute in Hong Kong. In addition, he's appeared on numerous television shows, including Iron Chef America, Top Chef, and Gordon Ramsay's Hell's Kitchen. I'd love to hear something about that. He's the founder and executive chef of MY China. Now, you could read that as Martin Yan China, or you could run it together as My China. I like the My China part. It works pretty smoothly. And soon to be seen on PBS is his latest show called Taste of Vietnam. Martin, I'll tell you, it's remarkable that you can get as much done as you get done. Taste of Vietnam, how did that slip in all of a sudden?
Well, in the last 5-10 years, I've been traveling back and forth Asia and the U.S. because one of my objectives is to bring the very best of Asia to America and to the world. Because the Yan Can Cook Show had been broadcast in about 50 to 60 countries around the world. And then at the same time, I thought, you know, in China, in order for them to be international, they have to understand more about food and culture. So in the last 5 years, I've been spending a lot of time traveling all over China and Asia, introducing American lifestyle, American food. I mean, not fast food, but American food. What American eat? What's the difference? What's the quality differentiation between French wine and a California wine, and also the cheeses. A lot of people in China, they never learn to appreciate cheese. They say, hey, there are over 400 variety of cheese, and many of them are made in America. So basically, introducing a lot of what I have experienced in America to my friends and my wonderful Chinese citizens in China.
Does that sound a little bit like the beginnings of a fusion cuisine where you can blend the cultures together?
Actually, I don't like to call it fusion cuisine, but what I'm doing is actually utilizing the very best of ingredients. Like everybody knows, the beef in America is much better than the beef in Southeast Asia. And also in many other countries, I wouldn't name it, but definitely we have superior quality of meat, pork, lamb, and beef. So basically I use that to prepare a lot of variety of Chinese dishes, regional dishes. So the ingredient is always the same. It's the cuisine is differentiated by the ingredient, the cooking technique, as well as the flavor profile.
Okay, but you're bringing together not just the American beef. When you're doing that, there are other elements in American cooking that do or don't get involved in that.
I'll give you an example. For centuries, because of the electricity and because of the kitchen and the kitchen design, and also because of the size of the home, a lot of time in the old days when I was growing up in China, one little apartment was probably about 2 or 3 families, right? So and then 3 or 4 families serve one, share one kitchen, one small kitchen. Nowadays, it's very different. Nowadays, a lot of the young people, they can afford to buy their own apartment. They have their own kitchen. So a lot of the places that in many parts of China, they can actually have an oven. When I was growing up, I never have touched an oven. Now, people are using oven to do a lot of things. So basically, I'm telling people, hey, oven, baking and roasting is one of the healthiest way to cook because you don't need to deep fry, you don't need to use oil as much. So basically, I use food processor. A lot of Chinese people have never used it before. I use blender, I use the whisk, a lot of these tools. A lot, not only tools, but techniques and ingredients. I'm trying to incorporate all of these into a lot of things that I do in China.
Let's go back to the oven, because that's really fascinating. When I think of Chinese cuisine, it's inevitably stovetop, quick pan stir-fry, noodles, of course. But I just never think of an oven. There's the Chinese oven that maybe gets that crisp skin on a pig, but it's a specific function, the pigs and the ducks that are roasted. Otherwise, there's not much in the way of braised foods
in
a normal Chinese restaurant.
That's very true. In fact, you go to Chinatown, you still see that when they do the suckling pig, they still roast it by hand,
right,
just like you do in barbecue. But the thing is, now with the technology, now you can have combi oven that you can control the humidity, and you can control the temperature and the humidity, so you can cook Peking duck. In fact, the Peking duck restaurant, Chen Jui Duck, one of the most famous Peking duck chain of Peking duck restaurant, they have about 130 stores. They actually use combi oven. Because one time, 5 years ago, I was working with an American company promoting combi oven, because a lot of restaurants, now a lot of hotel and restaurant kitchen, they actually have combi oven. And in fact, now you can even find that kind of steam oven,
right,
in domestic use,
for domestic
and
use,
for consumer use. So basically, you can actually roast a beautiful Peking duck, juicy, succulent Peking duck, absolutely,
and a crisp skin,
and a crisp, because you can program in such a way that in the last 5 to 10 minutes, no moisture.
So you know, you mentioned the Peking duck restaurant. I have to tell you about an experience there when one of the appetizers came out. The garnish on the side was a whole deep-fried scorpion. And half the people at the table shrieked, wondering, what is this all about? Well, of course, the fact that it had been deep-fried had eliminated toxicity, and you could just pop it in your mouth, as we did, and bite into it, and it was just a crunchy crunch. Well, that is to say, some of the people did that. Some didn't. I got a big kick out of it, but it was just one of those little showmanship things that gets its impact in a way that I've never seen before.
Well, let me share with you a saying. One man's food is another's poison. For the Chinese, anything that flies, they will eat, except a kite and a plane. Anything that with four legs, they will eat, except a chair and a table. Because in an agricultural society, in many of these places, what happened is food is scarce, right? Food is scarce. And you do not have the choice to come and pick and choose your food. You basically have to eat whatever is available, whatever is edible, whatever is good. In fact, you go to Beijing, you go to Wangfujing Dajie, on the food street, you can actually see. How many of you have ever been in Beijing? Now, you have been in Beijing, you have seen in this street. They actually serve you. They serve nothing but scorpio. You can actually see live scorpio. They fry it. Now, that is pure protein. Now, of course, the toxicity, because under high temperature,
right,
the toxicity basically just destroyed the toxicity. They basically, it's pure protein. It's no fat. And basically, a lot of calcium and a lot of protein. It's a pure protein. So Chinese believe you are what you eat. Truly believe you are what you eat. That's why.
So does that mean I'm now going to be a scorpion?
You know, you know what the Chinese believe. If you are slow, they ask you to eat brain. I've been eating a lot of brain. That's why I'm pretty fast. And if you have a problem with your liver, you eat liver. Because they believe the physical, the chemical structure and the DNA structure of the innards and the organs about the same, right? So if you just gave birth to a child, your parent or your mother-in-law, your father-in-law would cook you a lot of pig's feet and tendon to give it to the new mother.
Okay, but let's go back to liver, because when I was in the restaurant business, our most famous pate was our duck liver pate.
Yep.
And I used to buy duck livers in Chinatown. The butcher was all smiles when I showed up, because I would take 20 pounds at a time and I was paying 50 cents a pound for them. Whereas if I had gotten chicken livers from the regular wholesale supplier, it would have been a dollar a pound. And it was the one item that he said that he couldn't sell to the Chinese people. Now, why would they not be eating the duck livers?
Chicken liver is very popular, but duck liver is not as popular among the Chinese. Unless you go to a barbecue place, they actually have barbecue roasted duck liver and chicken liver. And talking about that, another thing that it comes to my mind is when you see a lot of chicken in the supermarket, there's no feet. You know where happened to all the feet? All the feet was exported to China. And then in every single Chinese restaurant, they have chicken feet.
Right.
And a lot of people, I don't know how many of you actually enjoy chicken feet. If you have never tried chicken feet, you don't know how good it is. Chicken feet is basically skin and tendon, a lot of ligament, a lot of tendon. It's actually good, pure collagen. So I run, I walk. I don't walk, I run. You know why? I have chicken feet every day.
What about this recent award that was just announced by the Chinese government that selected 10 individuals of Chinese origin in the entire world? Only 10 are chosen each year. A brilliance award. And you just received that. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's quite an
accomplishment.
Starting last year, they picked 10 individuals from around the world that are Chinese citizens who has contributed significantly to promote Chinese culture and also bring in other culture. That means they are cultural ambassadors. And last year, the nominee is Yao Ming and Lang Lang and the gentleman, the literary giant who won the Nobel Prize. And it's all living in China. This year, there are all 10 people living outside of China. And one of the Xing Yun Da Shi, he's the most famous Buddhist monk among the Chinese from Taiwan. And he has temples all over the world. And then Jackie Chan, and I'm one of them.
Well, congratulations. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Well deserved.
Because we always say food brings people together. Right, food brings the family and friends and people together. We all sit down around the dinner table. We're all friends. We're not enemies. We just talk about, we love food. And I love food. And that's how we get together and do a lot of things. And today I'm truly honored to share the stage with this gentleman. I consider him my mentor and a good friend, because we have done a lot of things on stage, and it's truly an honor.
Well, Martin, I'm just delighted to be able to be with you. Well, this is the Lunar New Year, the Year of the Horse. I'm tempted to say Gong Hai Fat Choi, because that's what everybody says, but I was talking to my doctor the other day, and he says he much prefers Sun Tai Ging Hong, which means I wish you good health. He says, well, yeah. As a doctor,
Sun Tai Ging Hong. It's true, because normally when you wish people, you don't just say Gong Hei Fa Chao, you always say good health. Not only good fortune,
so
but good health.
So translate Gong Hei Fa Chao.
Gong Hei Fa Chao. Gong Hei means to wish you.
Right.
Fat means to expand, to grow. Choi is wealth and...
To grow with wealth.
That means we wish you prosperity and
right.
good fortune. But my feeling is in America, we don't like the word fat. So I just created
a new version.
A new version. Gong Hei Choi, no fat.
Gong Hei Choi, no fat.
No fat.
All right, talking about the Lunar New Year, what about some of your favorite dishes for the Lunar New Year celebration?
I'm quite sure many of us here were brought up in a Chinese family and have attended Chinese New Year banquet. One of the most important ingredient that always used in Chinese New Year is fish. Fish is yu. In Chinese, called yu. Yu means abundance, plentiful. So when you serve fish, that means you are offering a lot of plentiful and abundance of good luck, good fortune, and happiness.
So give us a couple of specific dishes.
You can steam the fish. You can mix with sour fish. You can make chrysanthemum fish. You can braise the fish.
What's chrysanthemum fish?
You cut the fish, fillet. You cut the fish, you fillet this, and you cut it at a 45-degree angle and slice it. When you fry them, they open up like a flower. It looks like chrysanthemum flower.
Uh-huh.
And you, of course, one of my favorite is steamed fish with ginger and scallion. I eat a lot of fish. People always ask me, Martin, how come you never gain weight? You look at this physical specimen. For 88 years,
yeah. I
have not gained 1 pound.
I thought
138 pounds.
I thought it was 89 years.
So, because I think the most important thing, and people always say, you're what you eat. I eat a well-balanced diet. I eat a lot of leafy vegetables, eat a lot of fish, and I don't eat as much meat.
Now, wasn't a raw fish salad for a long time considered a really traditional thing for Chinese New Year's?
Yes. In fact, they still do that in some part of China and also in Singapore and Malaysia, called lo hei. Basically, it's sashimi, Chinese style, but they have all kind of stuff.
Right.
The Japanese sashimi is just bacon, you serve it by itself, but the Chinese sashimi salad is actually 8 different ingredients with crispy noodle and a pickled scallion, pickled this, pickled, and then you toss it. It's called lo hei. Lo hei means, a good business. So in Singapore and Malaysia, I just came back in Asia, they actually lo hei with a raw fish. So a lot of people don't realize the Chinese have been eating raw fish for hundreds and thousands of years.
I was so fascinated when I discovered that the raw fish used in San Francisco's Chinese restaurants for the salad was the hardhead, which of course is a freshwater fish and has those really vicious little Y-shaped bones that could get stuck in your throat. And the technique they developed for dealing with that, once they fillet the fish, they slice it into 16th-inch thick slices across the way the bones run, so you're actually cutting the bones into pieces a 16th of an inch long, and you don't have to worry about getting stuck with a bone.
So that's the reason why you have to have a sharp knife.
Right.
Now, I have a sharp knife. You know, when you have a sharp knife, you can cut the Japanese chef and the Chinese chef, they're very, very skilled, handlers. They can cut things paper thin.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you can cut the bone into paper thin, there's no bone left.
Right, right.
Yeah. But of course, you have to have a sharp knife.
Now, what about Chinese dishes that are not appreciated in America? Is there anything that is tradition in China that we have not been able to incorporate into the American culture?
Stinky tofu. Have you ever heard of that?
Ah, yes.
Stinky tofu is very, very famous. You go to Taiwan. You were in Taiwan, right?
A well-deserved title for it, by the way.
You can smell it. If you serve stinky tofu in downtown San Francisco, you can smell it in San Jose, okay? Stinky tofu is actually fermented tofu. Fermented for several days, and then you fry them. And if you go to Taiwan, you actually have an entire street to serve stinky tofu, to sell stinky tofu. A different flavor, different dipping sauce, amazing. And another thing is the Chinese-style salted fish, fermented, or shrimp paste. And both of these, just like fish sauce in, you go to Thai restaurant, a lot of people love Vietnamese restaurant and Thai restaurant. And you probably don't know that one of the most pronounced, most important seasoning is fish sauce. Fish sauce, if you just smell it, it stinks. It is very unbearable if you are not used to it. But when you put the steam, the fish sauce mixed with fresh lime juice and palm sugar or coconut sugar, you blend it, you create a multitude of color and flavor. And when you use it as dipping sauce, you go to any Thai restaurant, any restaurant, the dipping sauce is made with this fish sauce.
Well, you know, there's a tradition for fermented fish, fermented anchovy.
Yep.
Dates back to the first Roman cookbook in the first century. It's called liquamen. And if you look at a bottle of Lee and Perrins Worcestershire sauce, it has anchovy in it, and it's for that very reason. It's so loaded with glutamates that it just accentuates flavor and punches it up in such a beautiful way.
The umami.
Yes.
Because this is the new flavor dimension. A lot of people don't realize. They always say, oh, sweet and sour and salty, but they actually have different flavor, a different dimension. I think the key is, give me an example. When I go to a restaurant, when you order a Caesar salad, you always have to have anchovy. And I refuse to have order a pizza if they don't serve anchovy. Because anchovy adds a lot to it.
Pungent, intriguing, and it just that depth of flavor. That
just like a lot of people don't realize, it's, oh, soy sauce, but you don't realize soy sauce actually have over 110 flavor components. So that's why when you add soy sauce, you add 110 different flavor components. Layers and layers.
Now, if they could only learn how to make it without so much sodium, though.
Well, they have reduced sodium soy sauce, and which is only about less than 7%. But I always tell people, I'm a food technologist, okay? When you add something, when you add salt, you're adding pure salt, 100% salt. When you add soy sauce, you're only adding 7% salt. So on top of salt, you're also adding flavor.
A lot of other flavor.
So in a true sense, it's actually you consume less salt.
Well, I'm not going to believe that, but I'll take your word for it.
Believe me. I'm a food technologist. And of course, it depends the amount of salt, the amount of soy sauce
of
you use. And if you stay away from eating a lot of snack, any snack are loaded with salt, right? French fries loaded with salt. So I stay away from some of those things with loaded with salt.
Salt, sugar, and fat, those three evil things that the more you eat, the more you want of them.
I hardly take any thing with sugar.
Right.
And you probably notice, I don't know what you probably notice, when you go to a Chinese pastry shop, the pastry in a Chinese pastry shop is less sweet than the regular pastry shop.
Absolutely.
That's why the Hispanics love to go to Chinese pastry shop because it's less sweet.
Here's a couple that's going to Vietnam next month. Can you recommend any particular national specialties in the food that they should look for?
Of course, Vietnam is famous for noodle, the rice noodle. In northern Vietnam, they have the chicken pho. The pho is noodle. In southern Vietnam, they have beef pho. And you eat beef pho with a lot of spice and herbs. And that is a national dish. Anywhere you go to Vietnam, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And there's also another specialty. It's called broken rice. You see, sometimes you go to the rice, when you buy rice, it's all full kernel, not broken. But in a several restaurant in Ho Chi Minh City and many parts, they have to call the broken rice restaurant. They buy all this leftover cheap broken rice, and they cook all kind of dishes for you. They serve nothing but broken rice. Huh. So try that. And also, they have one of the most famous is the spring roll, of course. The spring roll, one is the fresh spring roll, right, the one we serve here, without deep fry. Another one is they deep fried it. Another one is very, very famous, you should try, is the pomelo salad and the green banana salad, a green papaya salad.
Oh, green papaya.
Or green mango salad. Though the Vietnamese eat a lot of salad. And they eat very little meat. That's why you go to Vietnam, you'll notice everybody's very slim, very slim.
Now, you made a reference to your being a food technologist. How important is that MS in food science? How important has that been in developing what you've done?
You probably know that cooking, food is not only an art, but also a science. And a lot of the food company actually hire food technologists and food scientists, as well as chefs, to come up with products that are not only delicious and have shelf, long shelf life, but also safe. And looks good, and it's also safe. And of course, food science is the study of food and the preservation of food, and also how to make food safer and also last longer.
Well, that sounds like it's the whole root of the evil right there.
Well, of course, when you make something longer, you have to add a preservative most of the time. So I think now we're talking about, the food scientists are talking about using natural preservative, natural ingredients. And of course, when you cook food, I always believe you should eat with the season, eat with the freshest ingredient. That's the healthiest way to do. And the Chinese have been doing it because Chinese have no refrigeration for thousands of years. And so a lot of the time you have to eat. My mother used to shop, go to the market twice a day, one in the morning, one in the late afternoon to buy leftovers. You go to Chinatown, you see elderly people, they shop around 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock.
Sure.
And they shop twice a day because they want the freshest possible.
Here's a really wonderful question. Talking about the cuisine in different regions of China, I know you could spend 2 weeks answering this question, but can you summarize easily or quickly the differences Hunan, Fujian, Shanghainese, Sichuan? Give us an idea. If somebody were to see a sign that said Sichuanese restaurant, what is that? What should they expect other than hot pepper?
In general, people consider China have four distinctive culinary regions, the east, the west, the north, and the south. But actually, there are 8 to 16 different regional cooking. The 8 different regional cooking is Lao, Shandong province, Zhejiang, Shanghai, Fujian, Guangzhou means Cantonese, and also Sichuan and Hunan and Guizhou. They're actually 8 very, very distinctive cuisine, regional cuisine. And each of them have very distinctive choice of ingredient, combination of ingredient, and also some cooking techniques. For instance, Sichuan cuisine is numbing. The mala is not only hot and spicy, but it numbs you, which is Sichuan peppercorn. When you buy this piece of Sichuan peppercorn, it numbs you. Okay? And
is that the long pepper?
Yeah, the little one. The little baby, the beige color, a brown color, little like a peppercorn. It's called Sichuan peppercorn. When you bite into it, it's not hot. It numbs you.
Right.
So that's the very famous. Without that, there's no Sichuan cuisine.
Okay, what about Hunan, for instance?
Hunan cuisine is very, very hot and spicy and much hotter than Sichuan cuisine. Sichuan cuisine, not all the dishes in Sichuan is hot. And some of the dishes in Hunan, most of the dishes in Hunan are pretty, pretty hot. And a lot of people don't realize, as both Sichuan and Hunan cuisine, they use 4 or 5 different type of chili. They use chili, dry chili, chili powder, pickled chili, and also fresh chili. So they have all kind of chili. They pickle them, they salted them, they fermented them. So that's why you go to Sichuan. A lot of time I do a culinary tour with the chef and connoisseurs. We take them to the spice market. You go to the entire market, they sell nothing but spices. And you see all kind of Sichuan peppercorn, all kind of chili, chili powder, chili flakes, chili, crushed chili, by the bags.
Cantonese, I guess, is the most common cuisine, Chinese cuisine here in San Francisco.
In San Francisco, also in the old days, throughout the U.S. Because most of the earliest Chinese immigrants is also from southern China, like my father from Toisan. Many of them are from Toisan. They came over here, the cuisine is the Cantonese cuisine, using steamed fish, dim sums and dumplings and things like that. But nowadays, a lot of the people from northern China, from Taiwan, from different parts of China are coming over here. So they bring with them Hunan, like we have good Hunan cuisine, House of Nanking, and the RNG. There are a lot of Greek restaurants around here. And they even have Hakka cuisine. And they have Shanghai cuisine. I remember 30, 40 years ago, I have never seen any Shanghai restaurant.
Right.
Now they have Shanghai restaurant all over the place.
I'm fascinated about dumplings. How do dumplings come from all the different regions and just have different characteristics, or are they more limited to places like the Cantonese cuisine?
Dumpling is popular around the world. The Jewish have certain master boy have dumpling, and the Polish have dumpling. All kind of cuisine, and the Japanese have jiaozi, and the Korean have a dumpling. In northern China, they have dumpling. In Canton, in southern China, they have all kind of dumpling. That's why they call it dim sum. It is, you go to a typical Chinese restaurant.
What does dim sum mean?
Dim sum is, dim means pawn. Sum of your heart. You remember you go to a Chinese restaurant, they push the cart around with all kind of variety. Sometimes they, when they push cha siu bao, ha gao, siu mai. So you just listen. You don't have to look, you just listen. When you listen to ha gao, then you order ha gao. If you don't know what they sing, don't order. You end up having chicken feet and duck feet. And then actually, there are over 130 different variety of dim sum. You go to a dim sum restaurant in Guangzhou, where I was born. You go to dim sum, the menu is about this big.
In Taiwan, we had the soup dumpling, the first time I'd been exposed to that. What an amazing thing.
Amazing. When you bite into it, it is filled with soup. The dumplings in the soup, but when you bite into it, inside it, it's also filled with soup. It's called gun tong gao.
Now, how would you...
Soup-filled dumpling.
How would you make that?
I'll show you when you come.
No, but seriously...
No, it's not difficult, but... it's not easy to make at home in terms of its timing. It's not... Basically, what you do is you chop up all the ingredients and then you also have some ligaments and pig skins, because pig skins is puffy. And you chop them all up and you marinate them and you basically, after you season them, you toss them in a wok and then you put it in the fridge so they become at room temperature. And then when you fold it in, it's easy to fold because it's cold. And then you have a special wrapper about this big, just like a siu-mai wrapper, but bigger. And then when you fold them, the dumpling is about this big, right? This big. When you boil them, they melt in your mouth because it turns a lot of these liquid, they have gelatin. They have a lot of gelatin and soup broth. And then when you freeze them, they become solidified. So when you fold them, it's easy to fold. Once it's boiled, it becomes soup inside as well as outside.
It was just an amazing experience. To put it in your mouth, bite into it, and have that juice just come bursting out.
Yeah.
The other really fascinating thing I had in the night market in Taiwan was baked in an oven. It was, I don't know what you'd call it in Chinese, but it was like a tandoor oven.
Yeah.
This deep side-walled thing with a fire in the bottom. And it was a man and his wife and their teenage son. And the son was scooping out lumps of this ground chopped meat that was flavored pork. And his mother was forming little lumps of dough, and she would put that meat in it and pinch the dough around it, and then gently squish it. And the husband reached into this roaring inferno and slapped these things up against the wall. I was amazed that they would stick there, because it's not like, I mean, I'm an Assyrian, and I know what flatbreads are, like lawasha, but that's just a thin sheet that you put out. These things were, you know, that thick with all the meat in them.
Yeah, I think what happened is when you make the dough, the right dough, will stick to the hot surface. So basically what he does is he just push it. And also the hot surface is not very smooth.
Right.
It's pretty rough. If it is smooth like glass, it would not be able to stick. So what they do is they just slap it on and push it in. And so when it's big, they know approximately when, then they move it out.
It was the most amazing thing. He was doing this all with his hand.
Yeah.
I was so entranced with the idea that the next day on the way to the airport, we digressed and stop just so I could get one to eat on the way to the airport.
It was freshly made. Anything when it's freshly made, it's all just like bread. When you freshly bake bread and you eat it, it's always very, very flavorful, very aromatic.
Now, you've worked with some of the most famous names in cuisine, from sensible ones like Julia Child to, I don't know how to describe Gordon Ramsay, so we'll wait on that one for a minute. But tell us about Julia. What kinds of things you did with Julia? How did you meet Julia?
When I was a freshman at UC Davis, I used to sit down, six of us, because we're so poor, so we take turn to cook. And we have three of us, we stay in one room. And no bed, just sleep on a sleeping bag. And we used to take turn to cook, and when we cook, we always watch, while we're cooking, we always watch Julia Child. And I told my roommate, I said, wow, she is so funny. She's also very, very good. Maybe one day I will be on television one day.
So then how'd you meet her?
And then what happened is later on, when I stopped doing television shows, that we do a lot of fundraising on PBS with Jeff Smith, with Jack Pepin, and Julia, and everybody. So we used to do a lot of things, and Julia always say, Martin, you're good enough. You don't need an audience. I said, I love an audience. She said, you don't need an audience. But she's always remind me, said, Martin, this business, you got to be passionate. You got to love what you do. And she loves what she does. And she's always very nurturing. She's very nurturing to all the young people. And I think I'm younger than she is. And also I was honored every time when she comes to San Francisco, or when I go to Boston or go to Chicago, she always requests, I want Martin to take me to have dim sum. She loved dim sum. Because she spent during the war, Julia and Paul spent 2.5 years in Guilin working for the State Department. Fighting in the war. So later on, at one point, Jack and I went to her house in Boston, and Jack and I said, "Well, we're hungry, and we want to have some breakfast." And he said, "You go and cook it yourself." So Jack and I actually went in the kitchen and take over the kitchen, and we start cooking for all of us.
That's
and
great.
Paul was, it's delicious.
That's great. Going back to these other characters on television, what about these shows like Iron Chef and Hell's Kitchen and others that seem to be successful more because they're insulting and intimidating other cooks and making a mockery of what they're doing? How do you figure that?
Well, you don't
is
see
accepted?
That. You don't see that much on. On Iron Chef. The Iron Chef is truly a true culinary competition. And I get on Iron Chef quite often as a judge. And they always ask me, Martin, why don't you compete? And I always joke with people. I said, look at this. All these are my friends. Like Kate Corey and Mario Batali and all of these Aramoto. And I don't want to embarrass these guys because I can go. You know, I can bone a chicken in 18 seconds. I guarantee they cannot do it.
Tell us how you really feel, Martin.
And if I compete, I'll finish all five dishes in 10 minutes. And then they take them an hour. I just don't want to embarrass them. So that's why I never compete. I'd rather be a judge. But actually, the reason why I don't want to do it is because it's really, really intense. A lot of time I see even the Iron Chef cut themselves. Because it's so intense. And it's actually only 1 hour. The actual cooking time is actually 1 hour. Mm-hmm. Actually, the taping is more than 1 hour. But while we're taping all the other things, they're actually still cooking. Mm-hmm. So they only have exactly 1 hour to cook. But of course, Top Chef is another game. Top Chef is different. Top Chef is all basically like a drama. You have a whole bunch of young kids, and then they live together, and they fight, and then they get emotional. And I always joke with people, how can they compete if they're always crying? I mean, they cry so much that when they cry, they can't even see the food. How can they cut? And then, of course, Gordon Ramsay. People are always curious. Is Gordon really that tough? And I said, well, I don't know. When I was there, Gordon Ramsay was really nice to me. Because I walk in with my knife and I said, Gordon, how are you doing? And Gordon said, Si Fu Yan. No, actually, I always believe when you're nice to people, people are always nice to you. That's why people always ask me, why you always look so happy? In a true sense, I'm passionate. Now, I've been doing this for so many years, I still love it. I still get excited about it. But people always ask me, how come you always look so happy and smile so much on the camera? This is the first time that I like to share with you. When you look at the camera, you look at the camera. When the camera's on, you see the red light, right? You see the red light?
Yeah. Two of them.
When I see the red light, I remind myself, there are $20 U.S. currency coming out. Then I'm excited because I know that I'll be handsomely rewarded. That's why I'm happy.
Now, how many of you knew you were coming to a true confessional? I have to ask you, is there some dish that you would call your favorite dish, something that just stands at the top of everything else, whether it's Chinese or otherwise?
If I have nothing, I would be very, very happy with a steamed fish. A live fish, I steam it, and just with a little touch of soy sauce and green onion and scallion.
And ginger.
But my actual favorite that brought a lot of memory is a clay pot, a pot of rice cooked with some chicken and some Chinese sausage. Because that's what, when I was growing up, my mother always cooked that. So whenever I cook that, it brings back a lot of memory.
Now tell us, how is the clay pot cooking done if they didn't have ovens?
Clay pot actually act almost like an oven. If you put something, you can actually bake a chicken,
right,
and a salt baked chicken in a clay pot.
So what, do they just put that directly over the flames?
Right. Clay pot can be this big, and also clay pot also have. In fact, my mother's kitchen only have one cast iron wok and five different sizes of clay pot. Make soup with clay pot. Soup of the day. You go to a Chinese restaurant, you soup of the day, they bring out a clay pot. About this tall, they have the smaller one and the big one. The great thing about clay pot cooking, just like clock pot cooking, is because clay pot is a slow conductor of heat. So when you cook clay pot, you have to heat it very slowly. And once it heats up, it retains the heat. That's why you go to a Chinese restaurant, you go to a hot car restaurant, you go to a lot of Chinese restaurants. They actually have in Chinatown, they have restaurants, including our restaurant. You can order some dishes in a clay pot because clay pot is so hot. It retains the heat so well. Even when you finish the last bite, when you go to the last bite, it's still hot.
Well, now how is the rice being cooked simultaneously?
Yes. When you cook rice in a clay pot, you have the rice crust, fanjiu, with the best tasting.
But then if you've got I'm thinking of these clay pots that have the meat and the rice all together. Would that rice be cooked separately and then added in?
Depends on what kind of meat. If you cook pork, you cook other things, I would normally cook it together. But if you cook seafood, I normally put it in when the rice is almost done. Because the rice takes about 18 to 20 minutes to cook.
Talking about rice, what's the possibility of brown rice making any inroads into Chinese cooking?
Not only brown rice. I love to encourage people to eat multi-grain rice. It's even more healthy than brown rice. Because at MY China, we actually have a forbidden rice, which is 10 different grains. When you eat brown rice and multi-grain rice, white rice, you remove the whole, and you remove a lot of fiber. You remove a lot of vitamin and mineral. But brown rice and also the multi-grain rice, everything is there. The nutrient, everything is there.
And so how do you cook that? It's not going to stick together as well to eat with a chopstick as you do the white rice.
Let me remind a lot of our friends who love Chinese food. The Chinese never, never eat rice, a rice dish with a chopstick out of a plate. They right. always put the rice in a bowl.
Right.
And they move graciously.
So in other words, you can shovel it in.
You shovel it in. Do you see how Japanese and Chinese, You know, the hungrier you are, the faster you push it in your mouth. But I have seen people, they try to pick rice on a plate with a chopstick. That is Hollywood style. That's not the Chinese style.
At this point, I'd like to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Narcy David, food and wine editor of KCBS Radio in San Francisco and the moderator for tonight's program. Our guest tonight is famed chef Martin Yan of PBS's Yan Can Cook, celebrating the Lunar New Year and discussing Chinese cuisine. So, Martin, brown rice you think is going to make an inroad. What's in that 10-grain?
The 10-grain is you got barley, you got winter wheat, summer wheat, you got glutinous rice, you got unpolished rice, you got brown rice, because you are eating the very best of the original. You're talking about the very best ingredient, and this is truly organic. And the important thing is about when you cook brown rice, you got to cook longer. You got to use more water because you have to make sure the moisture permeate into the rice hull, and it takes longer and more moisture to do it. So if you don't use the right amount of water and you don't cook it long enough, it will be so hard and you wouldn't enjoy it. So the key is cook it properly.
I just recently discovered a hull-less variety of barley that I had not known existed, because the only barley I've ever used is pearled barley, because the traditional barley, the husk clings so tightly to the grain that they have to grind off some of it, which means also lose some of the bran. But there's this new variety that is hull-less, so you really truly get a whole grain barley, as well as we've been able to get rye and wheat and oats and so forth for a long time.
A lot of ingredients are not available before. It's available now because of supply and demand. In the old days, when I first started teaching cooking class about 34 years ago, which the show had been on for 34 years, I started when I was about 12 years old, okay? People always say, Martin, I watched you when I was growing up. When I was young, I have good news for you. When you were young, I was also very young. When you were growing up, I was also growing up. I grew up with you. But I think the key is whatever you do, whenever you cook, I think it's about health, about what you eat. And always remember, stay away from too much salt, too much oil. And in our restaurant, we don't use MSG. And we use the freshest ingredient. We use a lot of fresh herbs and spices. And a lot of the food, we use Thai basil, Italian basil. I use lemongrass. I use a lot of the fresh. Even I've been introducing a lot of these new ingredients, not only from America, but from Southeast Asia to the chef in China, because we enter a lot of competition and we do a lot of judging in China. And I've been introducing a lot of these modern way of cooking. You know, you maintain your tradition and the spirit of cooking, but at the same time, there's no reason why you cannot take in new ingredient. When I was growing up, I have never seen broccoli. I have never seen asparagus. I have never seen artichoke. When I came over here, I love it, right? When I was in China, I've never seen avocado. Even 30, 40 years ago, I've never tasted one avocado. So now avocado is used in Japan, used in a California roll, and used a lot. So as a chef, as a cook, whatever ingredient is healthy, whatever ingredient is good, you use it. So that's what, as a chef, we are ambassadors. We introduce new techniques, new ingredients to people. And I tell you, I have not gained 1 pound all these years.
You know, you mentioned avocado being a new thing. I'm so fascinated. I did an interview once with a Filipino couple that had just opened they had just published their first cookbook, but they had a restaurant in New York. And they spoke about avocado. When avocados first got to the Philippines from South America, nobody had any idea what it was or what to do with it. Here's this tough outer skin, a thick, rich flesh, and a big seed in the middle, but it wasn't sweet. So they added sugar because it looked like a fruit. They figured this is a fruit that's just not sweet. They added sugar, they added honey, they made desserts out of it, they made ice cream out of it. And finally, when they came to New York, they were exposed to guacamole, and they were shocked because they thought this is a dessert item, and suddenly here it is being served as a savory. And this kind of cross-cultural thing must happen all over the world when people find a new ingredient they don't know what to
Definitely.
Do with.
We all know that in the old days, 100 years ago, people don't move around. You stay in the same spot. Now everybody travel all over the place, particularly American. We travel all over the world. When you travel, the first thing you do is you got to eat. So you eat local food. So as I travel, when I go to Thailand, I only eat Thai food. When I go to Vietnam, I only eat Vietnamese food. When I go to Laos, I only eat Lao food. So this way, I can absorb and I can learn as much as possible. The same thing, you know, wine is not very common. Great wine is not common in China. But now, you go to China, they are the largest consumer of California and French wine. They're the largest buyer. And yet, they still, many of them still don't know how to drink it. So I have been giving a lot of wine tasting, tell people how to pair food and wine. I actually have a program, actually pair California wine with food, with Chinese, with Asian food. To teach them how to appreciate, how to start with white wine, something a little bit sweeter, and then go into something drier.
Well, give us some examples of specific Chinese dishes with specific wine. If, starting from the beginning of a meal, take us through a meal.
First of all, a Chinese cuisine is always multi-course. It's like a tasting menu.
Right.
Never one main course or one protein. So Chinese menu, a Chinese banquet, actually is perfect for wine pairing,
mm-hmm.
because you have substance, you have different flavor, different protein. And I always believe, in terms of red wine, Cabernet Sauvignon, Pinot Noir, and Merlot goes really well with most Asian food. And of course, Chardonnay goes really well, Riesling goes really well. Actually, a lot of California varietal goes really, really well with Chinese and California cuisine. But you do not match the wine with the protein. You match, to me, my recommendations match with the flavor.
Of
course. And the cooking technique, not the protein itself. Because give you an example, fish. You can steam the fish. You can poach the fish. You can deep fry the fish. You can make spicy fish. So you match the flavor and the cooking technique with the wine.
Okay, that'll be a perfect example. Let's talk about that steamed whole fish with just ginger and scallions. What would you serve? What wine would you serve with that?
I would like to have a mild Cabernet Sauvignon.
Cabernet Sauvignon.
Sauvignon would be really good too.
Really?
Mild. Because fish, not only the fish, you're not poaching. You know when the Chinese use fish, they add soy sauce, right? They add ginger and scallion. So actually, it's a very good flavor component on top of the fish. It's not like you're just grilling the fish or pan frying the fish. You're serving the fish, but you on top of that, you have different flavor.
Right. Okay, now what about, you mentioned the fried fish. If it were the fried fish, what kind of wine would you serve with that?
I would get a drier red wine. Any drier red wine, because it's very, very strong. And you need something.
That's really fascinating, because most people in the West would think with fish, which is white flesh generally, they want a white wine. And yet, in both instances, you're recommending a red wine.
The reason is because when you deep fry the fish, in America, we hardly eat deep fried fish. And also, when you deep fry the fish, they also always serve with something else. They don't just eat the deep fried fish.
Right.
They never have just fish and chips. They always serve either sweet and sour, or they will serve pepper salt, 椒盐, always add flavor. Or they even deep fry the fish, they would sometimes put soy sauce on top.
Mm.
So you're talking about not just the fish itself, but the flavor component come with the particular dish.
Now, do you do much wine tasting in your restaurants? Do you offer wine?
We offer wine
to match with courses.
We have
wine by the glass.
We have a pretty good a wine menu, a wine collection, and we always train our service staff to recommend the right type. Always recommend, as that depends on what you order,
sure,
and the flavor you order. As I said, even fish, you can prepare fish so many different ways.
Do you have many different wines by the glass so that you can
yeah,
have
yes,
glass
yes,
with each course?
Yes.
You know, Asian cuisine particularly Chinese cuisine, well, throughout Asia, in America, seems to be a very inexpensive way to eat. I mean, people think of it as being cheap food. And I think sometimes that does a disservice to the quality and the real innate value of that food. Do you see anything happening to enable us to start thinking of Chinese cuisine as more than just a bowl of noodles and some steamed rice?
This is the same. Everybody look at Japanese food as just sushi and tempura. But you don't realize the kaiseki dinner, it costs you $500. You eat for 4 or 5 hours. And then you go to Vietnam, you think there's only a bowl of noodle. But you go to Hue, the imperial cuisine, beautifully done. And you eat for 3 or 4 hours. And you go to Thailand, also have imperial cuisine. And China also have imperial cuisine. The China also have high cuisines. A lot of people don't realize Chinese cuisine is actually have the imperial cuisine, the court cuisine, the restaurant cuisine, and the home-cooked meal. Very, very distinctive. And you can have a Chinese menu, a Chinese banquet, for $10,000 U.S. a person.
Wow. $10,000.
I have done a television program on an imperial banquet. You eat for 3 days. 118 courses. You eat for 3 days, okay? And they serve all kind of wine.
You provide bed right next to the table as well?
They provide you with Alka-Seltzer. But anyway, a lot of people don't realize Chinese cuisine with 5,000 years of history, it can also have high cuisines and also have
cuisine. I think the intent of this question was dealing with the reality of the way it's perceived in America. We encounter occasionally ultra-fancy, upscale Japanese restaurants, but you don't see many Chinese restaurants that are marketed as an upscale dining experience. People think of it as a place where you get a quick meal inexpensively.
I invite you to come to MY, China.
I plan to be there tonight.
You know why I mentioned that? If you tell us, okay, I want to spend $5,000, we'll come up with a menu that worth $5,000. If you said that I want to have a $10,000 menu, we'll come up with a $10,000.
How about a $500 menu?
But, of course, but you have to let us know ahead of time. So we pick the right ingredient, we cook it properly, and we present it properly. Cuisine is about using the best ingredient. Just like you use truffle, right? You use caviar. You use a lot of things. So you can have very inexpensive Chinese food. You can also have very expensive Chinese food, just like any cuisine around the world.
You spoke about these knives being able to shave food paper thin. Are there any particular brands of knives or style of knives? I'm feeling like I'm getting set up
here. I have no
here.
Idea what brand, but... But this
look at this.
This knife that I personally spent 2 years designing, this is razor sharp. Is really, they always said a sharp knife is a safe knife. You do not want to use a dull knife. This knife is just like any good knife. You have to use the right knife. Now, of course, because I'll be happy if anybody interested in the book and the knife. I'll be happy. Donating, instead of 15%, I'm donate 20%, 25% to the Commonwealth Club.
Wonderful, wonderful. So you didn't really quite answer that, except for our radio audience, I should tell you that he held up a Chinese knife that he personally designed, which has his name on it. So that.
No, actually, I can use this knife to cut things that are as thin as paper, and I can bone a chicken in 16 seconds.
Now, wait a minute. 18 seconds, you said a while ago. It's getting faster because you have a sharper knife.
The fastest I've ever done is 12.65 seconds when I'm in good mood with the right knife.
You said that the Chinese really don't like sweet very much. Do you feel that the Chinese restaurants in America are making sauces a little bit sweeter than they would be in China?
It's true, because I think... Just like Japanese restaurant, a Thai restaurant, they tend to use more sugar. And a Chinese restaurant, in general, use less sugar. But some of the dishes, like General Joe's chicken and sweet and sour pork, they tend to use a little more sweet and sour. But if you eat sweet and sour sauce, sweet and sour pork in China is less sweet.
Uh-huh. So this business of pumping in the sugar to balance the vinegar is really something that's done more here.
Everything is about balance. You know, Chinese food is about not only about ingredient, about cooking technique, it's about tradition, about heritage, about philosophy. The Chinese believe in yin and yang, the balance. It's a contrasting force, but at the end of the day, when they present a whole meal, it should be harmonious. It is contrasting and also well-balanced. Everything is about balance. Just like they call qi. Qi is about the body is balancing. So I don't practice qi, but I move a lot. And I inhale a lot. And I believe not only your food is what you eat, but I think it's food and exercise. I exercise a lot. I move around a lot.
We've spoken several times of different noodles. Can we get a quick run through about the basic differences in noodles, the glass noodles, the rice noodles, the wheat noodles?
I think the Chinese probably have the largest variety of noodles. The glass noodles made from the cellophane noodle, also called glass noodles, made from mung bean. So the mung bean, which is the bean sprout. So it's translucent. And then they have the rice noodle. The rice noodle, they have the glutinous rice noodle and the regular long grain rice noodle. All combination. And they also have the wheat noodle. The wheat noodle can be wheat noodle with egg or without egg. And it can be flat, it can be thin, it can be angel hair. So you go to China, each place is all kind of noodle, all kind of variety, all kind of shape and form. And you can cook it in your salad, noodle soup, stir fry, pan fry, deep fry, all kind of way of fixing noodles.
Now, unfortunately, this is going to have to come to an end. So there's time for only one last question, and I've saved one that you've probably been asked 1,000 times. What about that last meal? If you had to design your last meal, what would you want to eat?
The last meal I would do is still come back to have a nice clay pot rice with chicken and my Chinese sausage. So when I eat that, not only I can bring back a lot of great memory, but also bring back my mother's great memory.
Bring back those childhood memories.
Bring back all the childhood memory.
That's wonderful. Well, our thanks to Chef Martin Yan, food consultant, author of more than 30 successful cookbooks, host of PBS's award-winning series, Yan Can Cook. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and Internet. I'm Narcy David, and now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.